I'm Christopher Lydon for Open Source with the debut novelist Lisa Halliday and what feels like something new under the sun of American fiction. You're going to hear her reading from this nimble, quick, lifelike book titled Asymmetry. It's named for its three mismatching sections, which come to fit intricately and intimately together. First is a racy tale of an apprenticeship that is also a love affair between an old author, sounds like Philip Roth, and an aspiring young one, sounds like Lisa Halliday, though the names have been changed. Next comes a story that the young woman writes on assignment almost outside her comfort zone about an American Muslim in the Iraq War. The third section circles back to let the old writer present himself anew, being interviewed on Desert Island Discs, the age-old BBC program that lets guests talk about their favorite music and digress until they've stripped themselves naked. In all three sections of Asymmetry, words move like the wind. Let's just start with Zadie. I mean, no less an authority than Zadie Smith says, this book changes everything. They're not going to write long novels like her On Beauty, which I thought was fantastic. They're going to write elliptical, fast, exciting, masterfully, exquisitely verbal books like yours. What does she mean? And what do you think you've done here?
I'm thrilled to hear that she thinks that, of course, because I admire her so much. And an essay that she wrote many years ago now, Two Paths for the Novel, I read and have had in mind all this time. And it wasn't the only influence on the book, certainly, but I really did have it in mind as a prescription.
Remind us of her two paths and then the one you took.
Yes.
When you get to the fork, take it.
She was comparing Joseph O'Neill's Netherland to Tom McCarthy's book Remainder. And I wouldn't actually say that Asymmetry is neatly one or the other. It certainly isn't a densely written, lush novel in the historical tradition. I think what I took away from her essay is a new path for the novel might be, how can we capture what it feels like to be human and alive in a way that almost makes you forget the writing that is explaining it to you. I don't know if that's really what she meant, but it's part of what I took away from it. Almost an impressionism about life rather than description upon description. And indeed, there's a lot of description in my book, but I hope the effect is more a feeling, a sensation.
Yeah.
Something that captures the oddity of life, of being, the experience of just being in a day.
You've certainly done it. We'll get to what asymmetry means, but here we have three long, short stories in effect. People try to fit them together. It's tricky to talk about the first one, about a young girl and an old writer in Me Too time, in Cosby time, so to speak, but I think we have to. And I read it very, very differently, or at least not in the spirit of this age. There's the lesson, then there's the test, and then there's the wider reflection on what writing is all about. But the first one about the young woman, to me, vindicates a sort of Philip Rothian notion that in these sort of May to September or whatever relationships, what the writer here got out of it was a style, a view, an experience, a reading list, music, an incredible treasure of literary advice in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible?
Yes, and I would add to that companionship and affection. It was a genuine relationship that Mary Alice and Ezra Blazer had. I certainly wrote the book long before the Me Too movement became articulated. I didn't expect it to be discussed in this context. And of course, if the book had been published a year earlier, it might have been discussed more in the context of President Trump's travel ban, because of course that relates to the second part of the book.
Yeah.
So you never know when you're writing a novel what the current public conversation is going to be when it comes out. But going back to the Me Too movement, it's not for me to comment on any public allegations that have been made by actual people. I do think it's important to acknowledge that sometimes relationships like this happen, as you say, because both people genuinely want them to happen and both people enjoy them and get something out of them. They teach each other things. And one asymmetry in the book would seem to be that this older character has a lot of power. He's established, he's famous. Mary Alice would like to become established and famous, but she has her own powers and her own influence and within this relationship and also on her own.
Not only are they there for their own reasons, but it works wonderfully, I think. I'm not sure I should say this, but I met Philip Roth one time, interviewed him at length about his novel, Everyman, and when we'd finished, he went to the phone in his bedroom, I think, and I thought he was calling the friend of both of ours who had introduced us. And when he came back, he said, no, I was speaking to my girlfriend. And it turned out she was much younger. God knows just who she was. But I thought about it more than I like to remember. If one of my daughters had told me, oh, by the way, Dad, I'm seeing Philip Roth in a serious way, I decided I would have been thrilled. What a mine of experience, reflection, you know, ups and downs, but struggle, purpose, seriousness. He's walking with her. He's got a cane. He's not well. And she says to herself, this would look to anybody like a healthy young woman, losing time with a decrepit old man. But that's not the truth of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
At some point he says, tell me if this is something you're going to regret. And she says, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a good thing that you said what you said about your daughters, because had you expressed disapproval, they probably would have wanted to do it all the more. No, I think it could be insulting to a young woman to suggest that she doesn't know what she's doing, that she shouldn't have a relationship that she wants to have. That's life. We have urges and desires to know certain kinds of people and learn things, and indeed to teach other people what we know and show other people what we know. That's how you grow and compound your experience in life.
And all the while he's doing wonderful things for her. And I don't feel he's buying her, although he does buy her a fancy coat and gives her sort of credit here and there. But he's giving her blackout cookies and baseball history and every kind of jokes, especially the Hawaii. You call it Hawaii or Hawaii? No, it's called Hawaii. And the guy says, thank you. And the other guy says, you're welcome. The Barnes & Noble bags full of books that he wants the young woman to read. Death in Venice, Huckleberry Finn, Axel's Castle, whole variety. Not to mention the music. My heart stood still when he's instructing you in the classics of the 30s and 40s, my father's music.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also an instruction about writing and a sort of challenge. At some point after he's doped out that this young woman is in, not only in publishing, but she wants to write, he's coaching her. To me, this is a pivot in the book when she acknowledges, yeah, I've thought about it. I'd love you to read that part where and how she takes it.
For her part, Alice was starting to consider really rather seriously whether a former choir girl from Massachusetts might be capable of conjuring the consciousness of a Muslim man, when Ezra turned back to her and said, don't worry about importance. Importance comes from doing it well. Just remember what Chekhov said. If there's a gun hanging on the wall in the first chapter, in a later chapter, it must go off. Alice wiped her hands and stood to throw her napkin away. If there's a defibrillator hanging on the wall in the first chapter, in a later chapter, must it go off?
And then comes the story of the Iraqi family in the middle section of the book. And the Iraqi family is living in Bay Ridge. Their landlords are two musicians, one in the New York Philharmonic, one a sort of honky-tonk pianist, both with fish in their names. To my eye, it's just a sort of Philip Roth sentence. The novel is talking about Maxwell Fischer, debonair, too debonair for a nickname, a Bavarian graduate of the Paris Conservatoire. He was a devoutly trim man who took his early morning constitutionals in paisley cravats that on the pavements of Bay Ridge looked as exotic as if he'd wound an Indian cobra around his neck. Now, I thought, who but Philip Roth could teach the writing of that sentence?
I can see the similarity between his writing and that sort of writing, and that no doubt comes from my having read many of Philip's books over the years. That writing style of the second part of the book is actually much closer to my natural writing style mm-hmm. than the style of the first part of the book. And of course, the asymmetry of the two styles was deliberate. We read certain writers and they somehow, their work becomes ingrained in our minds. And yet I'd like to think as well that it has a quintessential quality that is only mine.
I'm sure. But you know what I mean about the energy, the imagery, the speed, the motion. It doesn't rush, but it's going someplace.
Yes.
The girl, Mary Alice, has set herself the task or wondered, could she conjure the life, the mind of a Muslim man during the Iraq War? And of course you do. But how did you set about that?
Well, that was the challenge. That was what really made the book that much more interesting to me to write. I have an Iraqi-American friend from college who was the inspiration for the character in the second part of the book. I had in mind for a long time to try to write about someone like him because he's just so impressive and intelligent. And I'd never met anyone like him before I went to college. It required a lot of research. I watched documentaries. I read memoirs. I read memoirs by war correspondents. Mm. I interviewed my friend. I also interviewed other people from the Middle East. Mm. I studied maps. I used the internet. I'm a very precise person, and I really wanted the second part of the book to be as credible as it possibly could, because this really is part of the point. Can someone like me or someone like Mary Alice write from this seemingly very different perspective?
Right. Could not that middle section about the Iraqi who's being detained in Heathrow Airport under the immigration restrictions while the war was on, could it not have stood on its own as a kind of imagined chronicle of the descent into madness and killing death in the imperial powers, United States and Britain, but awfully in Iraq itself?
Yes, I think it could stand on its own, and also the first section of the book could probably stand on its own as a novella. And indeed, many people suggested to me along the way, maybe you're writing two books. But I always wanted them to be together. It took a while to figure out what the structure should be. Mm. But I always had Alice and Amar together. And there's a line in the interview in the third section of the book about how writers often try to shoehorn characters together in order to get them into a room or onto a street corner so that they can talk to each other and so that their plot lines converge in that way. And there was a lot of that when I was younger. And then I realized that it was just producing something very stale and indeed boring to me. So it was around that time that I read a book called Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi, and the structure is similarly bifurcated. And that gave me the idea to structure the book in this way. But they were always meant to be together. If I had published these two sections individually, I don't think I would have said what I wanted to say about many things, about how the world seems to me. Mm. Again, going back to that impressionistic quality that I was trying to achieve with the book. I think we all go through life with a sense of now, but also what's happening elsewhere. And we're vaguely aware of it, and yet we're trapped in what a friend of mine, Louise Glick, has called the metaphysical fate of being always one person. I wanted the book to get at that somehow. And also I wanted to contrast the two styles.
By segment three of Asymmetry, the young writer named Alice has been to school and then delivered her original product. So she returns in part three to put her teacher on the radio to let him reveal his all, life, love, and art in her words.
The interviewer in the third section of the book asks Ezra Blazer, were you writing by this time? And by this time she means when he was young and in Paris and had not yet really established himself. And Ezra Blazer answers, trying to. I wrote some delightfully poetic little short stories, very sensitive short stories about, oh, I don't know, world peace, pink sunlight on the Seine. That was one problem, the rampant sentimentality of youth. Another was that I was constantly trying to shoehorn characters into each other's lives, planting them on street corners or in cafes together so that they could talk, so that they could explain things to each other from across the great human divide. But it was also contrived, contrived and meddlesome, really, because sometimes you just have to let your characters get on with it, which is to say, coexist. If their paths cross and they can teach each other something, fine. If they don't, well, that's interesting too. Or if it isn't interesting, then maybe you need to back up and start again, but at least you haven't betrayed the reality of things. In my 20s, I was always fighting this, always trying to force meaningful convergence with my ravishing prose, and the result was these airless little short stories that could not be faulted on the sentence level, but that had no resonance, no reason for being, no spontaneity. Nothing happened. I showed one to George Plimpton once, and he sent me a note that began, "You plainly have gifts, dear Ez, but you need a subject. This is like Babar, written by E.M. Forster."
You get us into this last section, a transcript of a Desert Island Discs interview with Ezra Blazer, the old writer, and I just laughed all the way through it, and I thought, why don't we all, A, start with the premise that the music we love reveals everything, and then digress, and you do it again and again and again. Some of it is Rothian almost to a fault, if I may say. He says, "I am satisfied that I couldn't have done any better about the end of his career. I never shirked my duty to my work. I worked hard. I did the best I could. I never let anything out into the world I didn't think I had taken as far as I could. Do I regret the publication of certain lesser books? Not really. You only get to book three by writing books one and two. You're not writing one long book. That's too poetic a way of looking at it. But it's a single career, and each piece is, after the fact, necessary to going on. I think yours, Asymmetry, is the best book Philip Roth ever wrote." I want you to read some of this. Would you read the interviewer, whose voice is stunningly true, too? He's talking about women in his early life, a dancer he married, another dancer on the rebound. And then she asks him, is it always about possession?
The interviewer asks, "Do you always use the language of possession when talking about love?" And Blazer replies, "It's impossible not to. Love is volatile, recalcitrant, irrepressible. We do our best to tame it, to name it and plan for it, and even maybe to contain it between the hours of 6 and 12. Or, if you're Parisian, 5 and 7, but like much of what is adorable and irresistible in this world, it eventually tears free of you, and yes, sometimes you get scratched up in the process. It's human nature to try to impose order and form on even the most defiantly chaotic and amorphous stuff of life. Some of us do it by drafting laws, or by painting lines on the road, or by damming rivers, or isolating isotopes, or building a better bra. Some of us wage wars, others write books. The most delusional ones write books. We have very little choice other than to spend our waking hours trying to sort out and make sense of the perennial pandemonium, to forge patterns and proportions where they don't actually exist. And it is this same urge, this mania to tame and possess, this necessary folly that sparks and sustains love."
It's an incredibly, should we say, literary but writerly book, this Asymmetry. There's another passage in the Desert Island Disc section where the old writer is talking about the book that every old writer loves to talk about, Joyce's Ulysses, the erudition, the wit, the richness, the great novelty of it all. My God, it's magnificent. But without the notes, I'd be lost. The Homeric analog doesn't interest me too much, by the way. In fact, it doesn't interest me at all. But I suppose on a desert island, it would start to, because what else would? You can only spend so much time with your blow-up woman, perfect though she may be. So yes, I'll go out with Joyce. The music. Mm-hmm. Chet Baker. Billy Eckstein, the great hero of Pittsburgh, and one of mine. The whole premise that a lot of the stuff he has to give you, this old writer, is
Mary
music.
Alice, that he has to give Mary Alice.
I'm sorry. It is fascinating to me and rings true impressionistically that what the old writer has to give Mary Alice is a lot of it music. It's Elgar's cello concerto. Mm-hmm. It's Shostakovich.
I love music and I grew up with music, classical music and musical theater. So that's why a lot of it appears in the book. And it was just so much fun to choose the music for this section. I think it's a beloved national pastime in England to imagine what you would choose if you were asked to be on Desert Island Discs, and I was able to do that without actually having been asked.
This third section is for me sort of the Mary Alice's crowing about what she has learned. She can do it all now, and she knows how to assemble a novel, a dazzling short story, just out of essentially a kind of connected list of musical favorites.
Mm-hmm. The moment I landed on this structure for the last section of the book was really a very happy moment, because I realized I could put so much into it and the reader could learn so much about Ezra Blazer that isn't obvious from the first part of the book, which is a much more private look at him. This is his public persona. This is what he wants to present to the world. It might give too much away, but I can read this. The interviewer asks him, "Ezra Blazer, you've written that depression is the inevitable crash after an untenable happiness. How often has that been true for you?" I should say that actually that line I got from a radio interview with someone back in 2008 who was commenting on the economic on the economic crisis. But anyway, it always just stayed in my mind because I thought, well, certainly that applies to other kinds of depressions as well. Anyway, Ezra Blazer replies, "Well, it's true whenever depression hits, which fortunately for me has been only two or three times. Once when I was left by a woman I hugely loved. Twice when I was left by a woman I hugely loved. Third time when my brother died and I was the only Blazer left. All right, maybe four times. But anyway, it's true of any sort of depression, emotional, economic. It occurs only after you've been riding too high. We ride too high on deceptive notions of power and security and control, and then when it all comes crashing down on us, the low is made deeper by the high, by its precipitousness, but also by the humiliation you feel for having failed to see the plummet coming. As I said, sometimes it's personal, sometimes it's economic, sometimes even a kind of political depression sets in. Lulled by years of relative peace and prosperity, we settle into micromanaging our lives with our fancy technologies and custom interest rates and 11 different kinds of milk, and this leads to a certain inwardness, an unchecked narrowing of perspective, the vague expectation that even if we don't earn them and nurture them, the truly essential amenities will endure forever as they are. We trust that someone else is looking after the civil liberties shop so that we don't have to. Our military might is unmatched, and in any case, the madness is at least an ocean away. And then all of a sudden we look up from ordering paper towels online to find ourselves delivered right into the madness. And we wonder, how did this happen? What was I doing when this was in the works? Is it too late to think about it now? Anyway, what good will it do, the willful and belated broadening of my imagination? A young friend of mine has written a rather surprising little novel about this, in its way, about the extent to which we're able to penetrate the looking glass and imagine a life, indeed a consciousness, that goes some way to reduce the blind spots in our own. It's a novel that on the surface would seem to have nothing to do with its author, but in fact is a kind of veiled portrait of someone determined to transcend her provenance, her privilege, her naivete. Incidentally, this friend, she was one of the... Well, no, I won't say that. I won't say her name. Never mind. There it is. What's the line? War is God's way of teaching Americans geography.
Lisa Halliday, this is magnificent writing.
Thank you.
It's extraordinary, and it goes everywhere, all the more that it's sort of ventriloquized into the mind of an old writer. But it's fantastic. In the last words of this man, Ezra Blazer, I just loved, in the first section, vindicating the seriousness, unconventionality maybe of their relationship, but he's in it deep. He's ennobling his own position. But he says toward the end, "Alice, don't leave me. Don't go. I want a partner in life. Do you know? We're just getting started. No one could love you as much as I do. Choose this. Choose the adventure, Alice. This is the adventure. This is the misadventure," he'd have to say. "This is living." Mm-hmm. I love it. Where are you taking the novel?
For me, the challenge was really, can I throw my voice in a convincing way in order to create an older writer in this way, and also the Iraqi-American character? I did a lot of ghostwriting in order to pay the bills before I published a novel. Oh. And that was actually excellent training for this sort of writing. It taught me how to tell a story from someone else's perspective without worrying about what people would think of me. You know, it takes the ego out of it. You're just focused on telling a story in the most vivid and compelling way as you possibly can. Certainly, I think all fiction writers would have to admit that they take things from real life. But the process of fiction writing, at least for me, is so messy. You take so many different things from so many different places. Mm. And to create a character like Ezra or Amar or indeed Alice, you take things from this person who said something to you in 2001. You take this thing that someone said to you in 2015. You take this thing that your husband suggested to you last night. And you take things that you've read, lines in movies that you love. It's a mess, the gathering together of these things and ordering them in a way that makes it seem like a seamless experience that actually happened, that has a kind of reality to it, a sense of reality. That was the challenge for me, to do that in each of the sections. The putting them together, as I've said, I've read other books that have a structure like this, a binary structure. I then added the last section, which makes it even more asymmetrical. But it just seemed to me right for the story. It seemed to me right in terms of rounding out the impression that I wanted to give. I didn't think of it so much as breaking new ground, certainly. Mm. If I had, I think I would have frozen up and I wouldn't have been able to write a novel. You sort of have to do it in a private, secret way so that you don't become too formidable to yourself.
Mm. Have we covered the asymmetry in the title and in the method, in the reading?
Mm-hmm. There's the obvious asymmetry of the structure of the book. There's the asymmetry between the character Alice and the character Ezra in the first part of the book. There's asymmetry between Alice and Amar in the second part of the book. Then there are grander asymmetries having to do with power and East versus West and what life is like in America versus life in, for example, Baghdad. Hmm. There's the asymmetry of yesteryear and today. We've talked a lot about the humor and the music and Billy Eckstein, things that are references to the past. And I love that sort of thing. Even when I was young, I loved old movies and musical theater, old forms of humor, just old-fashioned things. And my love of that has certainly gone into this book. But I also wanted to provide the counterpoint of very modern things. And that's really a lot of what the second part of the book is doing, thinking about what's happening today as a result of America's choices politically and what we might be in for as a result of those in the future.
Yeah, the whole thing is a kind of analog of an unbelievably asymmetrical world now of power and wealth and arrogance and suffering.
We've talked about how this is a novel, it's not a memoir, no character neatly correlates with an actual person, but of course there are similarities between me and the character Alice, Mary Alice. One of them is that I lived in New York during the early years of the Iraq War, and I was aware of what was happening politically in America and what was happening as a result elsewhere in the world, and I had a sense of, oh no, that's not what we should be doing. What can I do to have an effect on this, to sort of steer things back to where I would like them to be? But of course, then you're very busy. You're 25 and you're working long hours and you're meeting new people and you're trying to pay your rent. And so the sort of moment passes and then you feel guilty again when you see something on television or hear it on the radio about what's happening elsewhere. This book, in a way, was the product of a building up of my conscience to explore the results of what was happening during that time while I was doing something else, which is to say living my life. I don't know, I haven't answered the question, what good does it do to think about this, to imagine the life of an Iraqi American whose life and whose family has suffered a lot as a result of political choices my own country has made? I don't know. Have I done anything by writing the second part of the book? If we are to walk around living our lives, imagining what it's like to be someone living in Iraq, does that do any good if we don't actually convert that thinking into action? These are questions that I wanted to answer but haven't, but maybe that's fine because many novels ask more questions than they answer.
It's a magnificent book, Lisa. You're a marvelous writer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa Halliday. Thank you, Lisa Halliday, for Asymmetry, a big thrill in the reading, and the talking as well. And thanks to listeners for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project. Continue the conversation, please, with a comment on our site at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden.